This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana on the 30th day of April, the birthday of the state of Louisiana, the Louisiana Purchase, LSU. A lot of things happened on the 30th day of April, and Allie Baltazar is producing our show today. That's a big thing, along with Becca Dill. And our leadoff guest on the last day of April is none other than Dan Moldea, the intrepid investigative reporter based in Washington, D.C., the man who almost single-handedly, through his investigative work, brought down the careers, or at least changed the paths of the careers, of Bob Livingston, Newt Gingrich, and David Bruce Vitter. He is here to talk about the world as we know it and what an interesting world we are living in right now. Your number's 877-217-5757. Anywhere you are in Baton Rouge, the local dial is 297-5633. The email, talk at talklouisiana.org. And right now, Washington is abuzz about the correspondence dinner on Saturday. This comedian, Michelle Wolf, really put on quite a show, and some believe she went over the top, and many liberals were even, on the record, offended by her remarks. She described Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press secretary, as, quote, an Uncle Tom, but for white women who disappoint other white women, and took a shot at her, quote, smoky eye makeup, saying it was made from the ashes of, quote, burnt facts. Miss Wolf also labeled Kellyanne Conway, the president's counselor, an inveterate liar, and asked, if a tree falls in the woods, how do we get Kellyanne under that tree? So this is strong stuff from Michelle Wolf, but others are saying this is what happens when you have a comedian representing these journalists at the correspondence dinner, which has happened over and over the last 30 years. Dan Moldea, your take on this?
Well, you know, when they go low, we go high. And Trump has been rude and crude and name-calling and, you know, for years. And I've never heard one of these Republicans say, you know, he's stepping across the line, whether it's grabbing a woman's body part or imitating a reporter from the New York Times who has a neurological disease and mocking him in front of a large crowd. I mean, you know, with regard to this woman, did she go over the top? Of course she did. This town used to be kind of civilized, and at some point that stopped. I think I could trace it back to the Reagan election, 1980, when Lee Atwater was running the president's campaign, and he was running his Oppo research. And really, that's when the gloves really started to come off. God knows that there was dirty campaigning going on now, but this tribalism that's been going on, this town right now, which is in the midst of what is the beginning of what can only be described as a civil war, where everyone, as you say, Jim, is just clinging to their facts, and, you know, right or wrong. And as a consequence of this, you know, we have things like what happened on Saturday night. They should have happened. They did. It used to happen. You know, God knows Don Ibis really took a bunch of shots at Bill Clinton when he was president.
No doubt about it.
And, with Clinton sitting, you know, again, I don't hear the Republicans complaining about that. So, you know, it depends on who's being offended. This is the politics of resentment, and everyone's looking for somebody to resent.
Yeah, he took shots at Bill Clinton with Clinton and Hillary sitting right there beside him, and it was regarding Monica Lewinsky, and it was of the same vintage as what we saw the other night, but. The president opted not to attend. Sarah Huckabee Sanders did attend. And Dan, I know people who are not all that fond of the president and his policies, but they have a grudging respect for Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who may have the toughest job in the world right now.
You know, I know several people in the White House press corps, and they all believe she lies to them every day. I don't know the woman personally. You know, I don't think much of her father. I think he's lied a whole bunch as well, not just about politics today and in his desperate attempt to twist and torture the English language and his support for Donald Trump, but the things he said about the Clintons over the past, 26 or so years. They were both, you know, obviously both Bill Clinton and Huckabee were both governors of Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And so, again, it's, you know, again, I'm expressing my tribalism here. But when you get me, you know, I'm a journalist who takes sides. And, this is something that I'm taking sides on once again.
Well, I must say that come Wednesday on this show, we'll have the director of outreach for the Louisiana GOP, former state senator Albert Lee Guillory of Opelousas, who has another one of his videos out attacking the media for attacking President Trump. So
Well, the president's he's really been giving it pretty good back to the media as well. I mean,
oh no, I don't think there's any doubt. But Sarah Huckabee Sanders, she was even criticized for her appearance by this wild
over
man.
Over the line, no doubt about it. Over the line, Chip.
Scaramucci, yeah. Remember him? He was talking about how he didn't like the way she looked. Well, I'll say this for her: she was the daughter of a governor, a Republican conservative governor in Mike Huckabee in Arkansas. And when she went to high school during his term, she went to Little Rock Central High School. She went to a majority black inner city high school that, of course, is famous for its integration battle in 1957. But she did not go to a all white or mostly white religious school. She went to the public high school that is a majority African-American school in the great city of Little Rock. So Sarah Huckabee Sanders, she didn't look like she enjoyed hearing this, and I can't say
good.
I blame her.
Good. No more than Bill Clinton enjoyed hearing from Imus about his infidelities in front of his wife, as you pointed out.
But Clinton's an elected official, a big boy, and can give it as good as he takes. Sarah Huckabee
I think Sarah Huckabee has shown that she can give as good as she takes in the daily briefings as well.
All right.
She sits there and slaps these reporters down pretty well, calling them fake news and insulting the individual reporters and everything else. You know, so she could sort of take it. She's a big girl as well. And I think, again, this is faux outrage where these people are giving it, and then when they get it back at them, then they cry. They cry foul. And I hear what you're saying, Jim. I know you've always been a fair and balanced guy. You have a guy like me on, and then you have a guy like Roger Stone on. And you always walk the center, and you're always the reasonable man in these conversations. But this is getting personal now with everybody involved. And, again, I think reasonable people like you are going to be the peacemakers in the end. But right now this is a war that's going on, and we are fighting that war.
877-217-5757 or 297-5633 for Dan Moldea. David in Atlanta. Hello, David. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Thanks for having my favorite guest on, Jim. I have several questions. I don't know how much time we have, but I'd like to know what role, in the end, if the special prosecutor is fired, will the New York state attorney and the U.S. attorney in New York play in the likely prosecution of the president? And what roles will Roger Stone and Felix Sater play in the likely prosecution? And also, if I can get one more question in, should Trump pardon his attorney, that would allow his attorney to testify without taking the Fifth. Wouldn't that be a dangerous move for Trump?
All right, Dan, your response to David in Atlanta. Thank you, David, for calling. Always a pleasure to hear from you. And Allie, I think we've lost Dan temporarily, so let's see if we can pull him back up, and we'll get Dan's response. But David in Atlanta bringing up the possible state prosecution of the president, and if that were to happen, of course, it would mean that the president of the United States could not pardon himself or others for something that was prosecuted in the state of New York, where Donald Trump is not particularly popular in his homeland. He only got 15% of the votes in New York City in 2016, and ultimately, almost all of this comes down to political reasoning, and we're seeing that with Tom Shedler, the embattled Secretary of State for Louisiana, people who latched on to David Vitter and defended him and supported him three times in elections after he was admitted to consorting with prostitutes. They're castigating Tom Shedler, who, if these emails are accurate, and I'm sure they are, he's done some things that warrant perhaps dismissal from office, but it'll have to be his choice. He's an elected official, and he's committed no crime that we know of. We'll talk about that a bit later. But Dan Moldea, what about President Trump's vulnerability in state court in New York City? Would that be something that is
I think the gentleman perspective? I think the gentleman raised a very good point, and the state attorney general does not respect per se the pardon power of the president. Just because the president decides to pardon somebody, the New York Attorney General state court can proceed with his own prosecutions. And so it'll be interesting to watch and see what happens. Clearly, with Michael Cohen being the target of these investigations. Clearly, he's a target. It appears as though he's about to be indicted. The question is whether he's going to flip or not. And that's being handled by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, the Manhattan U.S. Attorney's Office. And with the State Attorney General moving as well, I think that the landscape is set for massive prosecutions in both federal and state in those jurisdictions. Now, with regard to Mueller, if Mueller is fired, I believe that the Congress will step up and they will reenact the independent counsel law and reappoint Mueller as independent counsel, as opposed to being which he would be picked by three appellate judges, and then he instead of being picked by the DOJ, so it would be very dangerous for Trump to fire Mueller.
We'll be back after this pause. This is Jim Engster. Pleased to have you with us on a glorious day in Louisiana, beautiful day, April 30th, and with us is Dan Moldea, the longtime investigative reporter who is back with a new version of a book he printed a few years ago, published, The Killing of Robert F. Kennedy, and next month, as in June 4th, will mark 50 years since Bobby Kennedy was shot. Actually, I think it was the early morning hours of June 5th at the Ambassador Hotel, 3400 Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles, California, where the Senator from New York lost his life at the age of 42. 877-217-5757 for Dan Moldea. Right now we're talking about the President of the United States, Donald John Trump, who in 1968 would have been a lad of 21, almost 22, when Bobby Kennedy was killed. Here's Jim in Walker. Jim, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Morning, gentlemen. I think the previous caller's on the right track with Cohen. When Mueller passed this over to the New York State District Attorney, there you're allowing for no pardons allowed for Cohen, but you're also allowing, once you start getting into this, the possibility of a state charge of conspiracy for Trump, let alone that New York is one of the few states in the United States which actually has adultery as a misdemeanor crime.
All right. Thank you, Jim. Dan, your thoughts.
Well, I can't imagine them prosecuting anybody for adultery, but I think the point he said was the point I just made, and that is the state attorney general can ignore a presidential pardon and proceed with his own prosecution of somebody whom Trump has pardoned. And it's not the district attorney's office who has it. It's the U.S. attorney's office. It's not a local jurisdiction. It's a federal jurisdiction. If the landscape was set for say Jeff Sessions to be fired as attorney general, or Rosenstein to be fired as his deputy, the person who controlled, Rosenstein being the person, of course, who is the boss of Mueller and his operation, then they could move as well as on the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan. I mean, that would be such an act of obstruction that I think even the Republicans in Congress, as bad as they have been and as spineless as they've been in standing up to Trump, I think even they would react to something like that.
John in New Roads writes, white guys 35 to 65 are the single most reliable voting bloc in America, the people the Democrats could always count on to win in statewide elections here and nationally. White guys 35 to 65 were locked out of the economy and culture for the Hillary generation. He finishes, Trump is in no trouble at all. Is this how Donald Trump won the election 2 years ago?
I think there's, I mean, I'm not, I don't think a lot of people are saying that those who support that those who support Trump are racist. But it certainly indicates that they certainly tolerate a racist, and Trump is clearly a racist. And I don't think that person is wrong is what he's saying. I think that this seems to be the last, and I'm saying this as a white guy, I think this seems to be the last gasp of white people trying to preserve what is becoming a new America, which is mostly made up of people of color.
Well, here in Louisiana, Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton by more than 20 percentage points. He received more votes than any candidate in the history of our state, and that's true in most of the 11 Southeastern Conference states. He won every one of them, 150 electoral votes in that block, by the way. That puts you pretty close to victory right there, more than half the way.
But at the same time, the person I'm hearing a lot being raised as a good candidate for president is Mitch Landrieu. I'm hearing Mitch Landrieu's name all over the place right now.
In Washington, D.C. You're hearing Mitch Landrieu.
I hear a lot of people talking about, praising Mitch Landrieu.
He's a darling of the media, and it's largely through that monuments decision he made. It is curious how something can take a life of its own. That did not play as well in Louisiana as it did nationally, but he might very well be a factor. And when he was asked on this show a few weeks ago, Dan Moldea, if he were running for president, he gave the traditional non-answer, which means, yes, he's running. At least he's planning to run.
Well, he's looking good. He's standing tall right now, so it's going to be interesting to see what happens. I think a Southern governor would be terrific to run. A Democratic Southern governor would be a terrific candidate.
Former lieutenant governor.
A Southern district mayor or governor, an executive, somebody from the executive, somebody who knows how to run things.
Well,
some people who know how to run a bureaucracy. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
I keep thinking of when I got involved in the race when David Vitter ran for governor in 2015. And, you know, I was thinking, I think I got a call from Stormy Daniels back in 2010. She called me as Stephanie Clifford. I think that she was thinking about running against David Vitter in the primary, and she was running as a Republican, as I recall, or she was thinking about it. And I forget the gentleman from the Republican Party who made the connection. I didn't put much stock in it because I was getting a lot of calls from a lot of people there in Louisiana.
Well,
of course, Vitter survived that re-election bid in 2010, and then it cost him in 2015.
Well, ultimately, she decided not to run, and that brings us to a question from Linda. Linda in Mid-City asking if Hillary Clinton had been caught with a porn star, paid $130,000 in hush money to a porn star, would she be vulnerable right now if she were president?
Oh, Hillary Clinton would already be impeached and removed from office if she had been elected president. I think that the stage was set that if she had won the election, that they were going to come at her with everything they had, whether it was this bogus email scandal or the attacks on the wonderful Clinton Foundation, which is a true eleemosynary, a true philanthropic organization. And as great a president as Hillary Clinton would have been, you know, the smear campaign against her, which has been going on for how many years now, 26 years now, would have continued. And she would have, whereas Donald Trump is getting away with things that nobody, and I mean nobody, can get away with.
Well, it is interesting that a lot of people who are pouncing on Bill Clinton are very forgiving of Donald Trump the other way around, too. A lot of people who defended Clinton in 1998 are pouncing on the president. Does politics trump everything? Pardon the pun.
You might be right, Jim. As usual, you're hitting a nail on the head in that you have people like, I was talking to another journalist last night about this at a dinner party, and we were talking about Kirsten Gillibrand from New York, the senator from New York, who has been a beneficiary of the Clinton support and money over the years. She replaced Hillary Clinton with the Senate when Hillary became Secretary of State under President Obama. And she was the one who was basically saying that Bill Clinton should have resigned in the midst of the Monica Lewinsky scandal. You know, I still think that there's a difference between, consensual affair and something which, where Donald Trump is bragging about, grabbing women by their private parts. And imagine Barack Obama being captured on tape saying something like that. Imagine the reaction that would have caused. Is there a double standard? Yeah. Is the hypocrisy swinging both ways? I guess it is. But at the same time, Donald Trump is so over the top on so many different things and in so many different areas that, my goodness, I mean, just the fact that this guy, by PolitiFact, the Pulitzer Prize-winning website, which deals with what is fact and fiction on the Internet, has clocked almost 3,000 flat-out provable lies that Donald Trump has told since he's been in office. That's like 5 to 6 per day. you know, the default should not be that the president in this particular case is telling the truth. The default position is that he's a liar and that he's lying on just about everything he says. I don't trust anything he says or does.
All right, 877-217-5757. It is notable that Donald Trump has held support with most of the Republican throng in Washington, including Louisiana's congressional delegation. Very few harsh words, if any, coming from the two U.S. senators, John Kennedy and Bill Cassidy, and also the five U.S. House members who are Republicans have, for the most part, stayed true to Trump. We'll talk with Dan Moldea some more, and we'll also discuss the Tom Shedler saga. And a reminder that come Wednesday, we'll hear from the other side on the Trump story from former State Senator Elbert Lee Guillory of Opelousas, Director of Minority Outreach for the GOP in Louisiana. He is still bullish on the President of the United States. 877-217-5757 is your number, and we'll be back with more Talk Louisiana after this pause for the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. We're spending a few more minutes with the celebrated investigative reporter Dan Moldea. I mentioned in the open that he is largely responsible for career changes for one David Vitter, one Bob Livingston, and one Newt Gingrich, and a listener, Diane, in Mid-City, really just notes that all three of them became lobbyists. Isn't that the fallback position for everybody in Washington? They get this Potomac fever, and they see the big dollars, and even when they're disgraced, they seem to find solace in the lobbying world, Dan Moldea.
I think that you can also say that about journalists. There's all these buyouts that are going on in newspapers around here, and you'll see a lot of these reporters will take their buyout money and start private investigations firms, consulting firms, lobbying firms. And, I mean, Fusion GPS, what was that? The guys who hired Christopher Steele, you know, it was journalists from the Washington Post who had gotten their buyout money and decided to go into business. And so, you know, people say life is short. It's not. It lasts a long, long time. And if you're in a situation, you get disgraced by one thing or another or be forced out of your job for innocent reasons. You know, you have to go on, and people are creative enough to find ways, ingenious ways to make a living, and that's what they do. I don't fault Livingston, Vitter, Gingrich, or any journalist for doing what they're doing.
All right.
They're doing what they have to do to take care of themselves and their families.
Well, Dan has reissued his best-selling book, The Killing of Robert F. Kennedy, An Investigation of Motive, Means, and Opportunity, 50th Anniversary Edition. As mentioned, next month will mark the 50th anniversary of the assassination of then 42-year-old U.S. Senator Robert Francis Kennedy, front-runner for the Democratic presidential nomination. He just won the California primary, and he was killed in the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel, and we've talked before about this, but you are fervently of the mind that one Sirhan acted alone. Why do you believe this, Dan Moldea?
Well, I had started this investigation in 1985, and I believe that there was a security guard there named Gene Caesar who had a gun on his hand and powder burns on his face. He was hired by the hotel for crowd control. I thought he had done it. And I spent a lot of time, hundreds of hours, investigating him, interviewing him, and everything else. Finally, I needed some test or measurement to determine how much time and money I was going to spend on him. And so I asked him if he would do a polygraph test, and he did. I got the best polygraph operator on the West Coast, the head of the American Polygraph Association, Al Gelb, to do the polygraph, and Caesar passed with flying colors. So I turned my attention to Sirhan. I had three interviews with Sirhan lasting about 14 hours, and it was clear to me that this guy had done it, and he had done it alone. Now what you're about to see, Jim, for this 50th anniversary is you're about to see people, very high-powered people like Robert Kennedy Jr., coming out publicly and saying that that Sirhan did not do it, that Sirhan is an innocent man wrongly accused. And they're going to be clinging to what I consider to be some fairly bogus information and evidence in order to stake that claim. And that's going to be coming very shortly here as the 50th anniversary approaches. On June 5th, 1968, as you pointed earlier, he was shot by Sirhan on June 5th. He lived for a day and died on June 6th. So you're going to be seeing a lot of anniversary stuff going on. Mm-hmm. In my book, which says that Sirhan did it and did it alone, and Caesar is an innocent man wrongly accused, I tell you up front who did it. The adventure is not so much in the destination, but during the trip to get there, I sort of wrote it like a Columbo. And, again, great reviews for the book. I'm very proud that I'm reissuing it. I've updated it, and I hope people enjoy it.
And you actually got a call from Robert F. Kennedy, Jr.
I did get a call from a couple of calls from Bobby Kennedy, Jr., and I have been sort of keep holding back what the specifics of what we talked about, but he did make it clear that he believed that Sirhan is an innocent man wrongly accused. And obviously I've been very critical of this because I think he's getting conned. And I'm going to be interesting to see what they – in order to get to Caesar, you have to go through me. And there are several attempts to try to get to Caesar right now, and people are coming through me, and people seem to think that something is about to happen, that there is some – brand new piece of evidence getting ready to spring out. I'm not allowing Caesar to walk in. I have his power of attorney, and I'm not going to. He's old and ailing now, and I'm protecting this guy because I am absolutely convinced that he's an innocent man wrongly accused. And so what I'm doing is I'm waiting to see what's happening before I allow him to walk into an ambush interview, as I had done for so many times. I was among those who was guilty of falsely accusing this guy of the murder of Senator Kennedy, whom I believe was the greatest crime fighter this country has ever had. And again, I'm sad to see his son. And I have offered, there's going to be a documentary revolving around him, and I've offered out of respect for him, his family, and my late mentor, Walter Sheridan, who was like a brother to a lot of people in Louisiana. The older people remember Walter Sheridan's name. He was the guy who brought down Jim Garrison and for NBC News. Mm-hmm. And, what can I say? Garrison, what, mob stooge? Marcello mob stooge? What was he? You know, a person who was deflecting attention away from Marcello, Tropicana, and Hoffa.
You brought up Jim Garrison. You debunked Garrison, as almost everybody has, except Oliver Stone. But
great movie, horrible history.
Yeah. But as fervently as you believe that Bobby Kennedy was killed by one man, Sirhan, you believe that Jack Kennedy was killed in a conspiracy.
Right. I think that he was murdered by in a conspiracy revolving around Jimmy Hoffa. I think it sprang out of the CIA mafia plots to kill Castro. I think that it was Jimmy Hoffa, Carlos Marcello, and Santo Trafficante. Of course, everyone in Louisiana is familiar with the late Carlos Marcello. Santo Trafficante was the mafia boss of Tampa. Of course, Hoffa was the president of the Teamsters Union. I made this claim for the first time. I was the first person to make this claim and lay it out in my first book in 1978, The Hoffa Wars, about the rise and fall of Jimmy Hoffa. A year after my book came out, the U.S. House Select Committee on Assassinations concluded Hoffa, Marcello, and Trafficante had motive, means, and opportunity to kill President Kennedy, and the chief counsel of the committee, Bob Blakey, the world's expert on organized crime, the author of the RICO legislation in 1970, he came out and publicly said the mob did it. It's a historical fact.
All right. Well, Dan Muldea, it's always an honor to talk with you. And
Jim, it's always a pleasure talking to you. And also, I like your new music, setting up and leading into your show. Great music.
Well,
I love
wonderful.
It.
Wonderful.
Sitting here tapping my foot and snapping
Lewis,
my fingers.
Yeah. Well, we'll be calling again soon as we approach the 50th anniversary of Bobby Kennedy's untimely death.
Always a pleasure, Jim. Thank you,
care.
Sir.
Take care. Bobby Kennedy, dead at 42 years old, same age that Huey Long was assassinated, by the way. Martin Luther King was 39. John Kennedy was 46. A lot of young men were killed in the prime of life, and oh, how the world might have been different if they had lived full lives. Tom Shedler is not a young man. He's 68 years old, but he is a man who's won twice as the elected Secretary of State, defeating in the first race, a very close race by fewer than 10,000 votes. He beat Jim Tucker, and then he won rather comfortably over Chris Tyson last time and appeared to be on his way to perhaps getting a third term, but he says he will not seek re-election in October of next year, but he would like to serve out his term despite allegations that he has behaved inappropriately with one of his subordinates. And Jim Shannon is in studio with us. He is the husband of Jill Kraft, the attorney representing Dawn Ross, and Jim works for the Louisiana Radio Network, which I am the proprietor of. And last Friday, Dawn Ross, a longtime employee of the Secretary of State's office, sat down with Jim and made some comments. And, Allie, let's listen to a bit of Dawn Ross's statement about her relationship, or lack thereof, with Tom Shedler.
I told him he needed to stop, you know, and to leave me alone multiple times.
All right. Let's give one more listen to Dawn Ross.
I would ignore a lot of the comments he would make in emails or texts.
All right, but now she is coming forward. And many media outlets had declined to mention her name, but now she is obviously going public with this, and she is still an employee with the Secretary of State's office. As mentioned, you were connected to her attorney as the husband of Jill Kraft. But Jim Shannon's a longtime reporter. Many of us remember him for years on WAFB. When you were interviewing her, what kind of demeanor did she have?
She was extremely nervous just to talk to the radio. I was used to television for many, many years, and the lights and the cameras can be intimidating. I understand that. But with this, with the radio, it's not quite as intimidating unless you're sitting across from Jim Inkster. But poor Dawn, she really was nervous. But she was nervous in a way that because she was recounting in her head what she wanted to tell her story. And that's why she did the interview. She wanted to tell people her story. But the thought of what had been going on with her all the past few years really got her all worked up and nervous. We talked for about 15 minutes before I even turned the recorder on, just to try to get comfortable. And even at that point, 10 minutes into the interview, it was a total of, I think, 24 minutes, she finally started to relax just a little bit and get over some of the angst.
All right. Now, we had some listeners who obviously had heard the promo and knew that this would be a topic, and here's an email from Juliet asking to read the interview in printed form. She doesn't deny a consensual relationship, deflecting with, quote, disgust and never was interested. Do you get the impression there might have been a relationship there, or do you believe that there was no relationship and that Tom Shedler continued to pursue one?
Her believability to me is very high, and I've interviewed thousands of people, and I kind of know when people are trying to pull the wool over your eyes. But with Dawn, I truly believed her. I think that as this case continues to unfold, that you'll see even more evidence to prove that.
All right. Well, and of course, Jim has a vested interest in being the husband of Jill Kraft, but he did get the interview with Dawn Ross. We'll spend a few more minutes with this. And, of course, if Tom Shedler is willing and eager to talk, we'd love to hear from him as well. So, Tom, this is your invitation, and we're back after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Coming next, we'll visit with two best-selling authors, Amy Nobley and Tricia Ashworth. They were authors of I Was a Really Good Mom Before I Had Kids. Their latest is Just When You're Comfortable in Your Own Skin, It Starts to Sag. But we're finishing up with Jim Shannon, longtime reporter, and in this case, he has a vested interest. He's the husband of the well-known attorney Jill Kraft, and she is representing Dawn Ross. And Jim, who is an assistant news director with the Louisiana Radio Network, he got an interview with Dawn Ross last week, the first time this woman has spoken, and she is the lady who has brought allegations of sexual misconduct against Tom Shedler. Many are calling for his resignation, including U.S. Senator John Neely Kennedy, who we reminded listeners last Friday, defended David Vitter through three elections, and Vitter acknowledged committing a crime in a sexual misdeed. But this is different, and Tom Shedler doesn't have many supporters right now. And the question that this woman, Dawn Ross, has kept her job. She claims the last 10 years have been living hell. Why do you think she's coming forward at this point, Jim Shannon?
Well, I asked her that on Friday, Mr. Inkster, and she said that he finally pushed my last button. And it was a simple response, but, you know, people get to a point where they've just had enough. Mm-hmm. And her explanation of that, because a lot of people have been asking that, well, why would you stay? Why wouldn't you just leave, go somewhere else? Not all people can do that. She was a single mom for a long time, and she needed that job that she had. So,
well, she's kept her job, and what is she seeking?
Well, I think in civil suits, the relief is obviously money. And so I know that Jill never really will ask for a specific amount. She'll tell a jury, you know, you just do what you think is right. And and she wanted it to stop. She wanted the harassment to end, mm-hmm. which it has.
Right. Well, quite often these cases never go to trial. And,
right.
and this one, my guess, probably will never go to trial. Is there some settlement negotiation ongoing?
Well, I think in cases like this, they're always ongoing, and they're certainly an option. So who's going to make the call? At what point is that? I don't know.
Well, I'm getting some people who actually are supportive of Tom Shedler who are emailing me here, and it's put him in a situation where he's damned if he does, damned if he doesn't, but there are many calling for his resignation. You've been a journalist for a long time. This is akin to death by a thousand cuts. Do you think he'll withstand this?
I think it's easy to fight a battle, Jim, when you're using somebody else's money to fight with.
So you're saying his attorney, and I think this has been verified, that he has at least one attorney who is being paid for by the state of Louisiana, and we've had these cases where state money has been used to settle sexual harassment cases, so he's not alone.
True, he's not. But again, if he was to walk away, then the suit would probably continue.
All right. But in the interest of fairness, if Tom Shedler wishes to appear or a representative of Secretary Shedler, we welcome that opportunity. And, Jim, thank you. You got the exclusive interview, and we'll see what happens. But my guess is that Dawn Ross is back at work today.
Yeah.
A question came from a listener. Was she interviewed at her office?
At Jill's office.
At Jill's office. Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Jim Shannon, good to talk with you, as always. And now we're joined by two best-selling authors, Amy Nobley and Tricia Ashworth. Just When You're Comfortable in Your Own Skin, It Starts to Sag. That's their book, Rewriting the Rules of Midlife. And good morning. Nice to talk with you.
Good morning. Good morning. Happy to be here.
All right. You say you're redefining what beauty means after 40. I hear people saying 40 is the new 30 or whatever, but at some point our bodies change, our faces change. What can we do to stem the tide, or should we?
Right. So Trish and I have written 4 books, and we always interview hundreds of women depending on the phase that we're in. This phase is that dirty little secret, midlife. We all hate that word because we don't feel like we're in midlife. We heard over and over from women that we are not our mother's 40. We are a guinea pig generation, and so we are different. We talked a lot about the definition of beauty and the need to redefine that. There's a lot of pressure right now in this generation to look younger and feel younger, but at the same time, we all need to figure out what makes us truly feel beautiful.
Well, is it a matter of feeling beautiful? Does that start the process of being beautiful?
Well, it is interesting. We asked women, when do you feel the most beautiful? And it certainly was not staring in the mirror with a magnifying glass. It was, you know, when I leave yoga and I feel strong, or when I'm with a girlfriend and we're giggling and having a glass of wine, like, we're looking at it a little bit differently, and beauty is becoming more internal, and therefore it you look different on the outside because you're more confident and you feel more beautiful.
I see a chapter titled, Is This Really the Only Husband I'm Ever Gonna Have?
Oh, yeah, well, we heard that over and over again. It's interesting. In this generation, women are much more apt to make choices that are right for them versus maybe they are not going to stay in a marriage for 40 years like they watched their parents do. So there are, you know, there are a lot more divorces happening 40 plus in midlife, and more women than ever are initiating the divorce. So it really is, this is a time when women feel empowered to build their voice, use their voice, have a voice, speak out, and really own the next chapter of their lives, and maybe
and
that, the better second half of their lives.
Mm-hmm. And that may mean reinventing their marriage as well. So if they choose to stay in a marriage, make it as healthy and as rewarding and as fulfilling as it can be. It's a time when our kids start to, you know, leave the nest, and we do look at our husbands and say, who are you? And there's a huge opportunity to make the, you know, your relationship with your husband, with your friends, you know, really reinvent it and have it be beautiful and healthy.
You say this book is designed for people who, when they're entering their birth date on a website, and I've done this, it takes a full minute to scroll all the way down to your year.
Oh, yeah. It's a very surreal thing. You know, we talked to so many women who said, well, I'm not in midlife. You know, these are women 40, 50, 60. Well, that's not me. That's not how I feel. And so it's our mission really is to sort of rebrand midlife. And every woman said, I don't like that word. So we said, all right, what's another word for it? And the word we landed on was perennial. We much would rather look at ourselves as perennials, everlasting, ever blooming, more beautiful year after year. So rebranding midlife.
And also you say it's for people who feel wiser than ever and don't care what others think about them. Is there anybody on the planet who really doesn't care what others think?
Well, it is an interesting time when you are, you know, we're finally at this age where you internally feel like, you know, I want to become myself. I want to own my own choices. And you want to surround yourself with people who are judgment-free. And that's part of the process, is making sure that you're surrounding yourself with people who make you feel that way. So you're not conscientious of these things, these choices you're making. You are empowered to make them and feel great about them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a book that certainly relates to the times. You have a chapter called Balancing an 18-Year-Old and a 78-Year-Old, Entering the Perfect Storm. What do you mean?
Right. Yeah, so it's a really interesting time to be in this phase, especially as a woman, because we are having kids older. And what's happening, we're not even expecting it necessarily, but our parents are really aging pretty rapidly, and all of a sudden we've got teenagers, and they're hormonal, and we're hormonal, and then all of a sudden you don't know whether that call in the middle of the night is going to be about your 8-year-old mother or your 18-year-old son. And so it is a tremendous amount of pressure. And we talked to a lot of women who thought, oh, wait, I thought this was going to be my time. But then all of a sudden they're caregiving again, and it's a really stressful time.
I saw the president of France and his lovely wife last week. She's 64. He's 40. Is this something that perhaps we'll see more of? We're already seeing some of it in our country. Is it going to be more and more the case?
Well, it's really interesting because we did talk to a lot of women who are dating younger men. Again, there's more of a European sort of thought process that's happening. It's starting to evolve because America can be very traditional in terms of its mindsets. We talked to a lot of women who said, I'm not even a cougar, I'm a puma. That's what I want to be known as. And, you know, sort of ageless and timeless, and women can date any age, just like men have always been able to do. So the rules are definitely evolving.
Well, congratulations on your fifth book, destined to be another bestseller. Just when you're comfortable in your own skin, it starts to sag. Rewriting the Rules of Midlife, Amy Nobley and Tricia Ashworth, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
And Elizabeth Partridge was slated to be with us today. Her book is Boots on the Ground, America's War in Vietnam. She is now slated for tomorrow, as in Tuesday. And we'll also hear from Peter Kovacs, the editor of The Advocate. Tomorrow marks 5 years since The Advocate was sold to John Georges and the first New Orleans edition was published. We'll talk with Peter Kovacs about the state of The Advocate and the state of newspapers and an ever-changing media world. And, of course, we have this mantra of fake news that's ongoing. We'll visit with him about that as well. For Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill, I'm Jim Inkster. Hope you have a fabulous day. Thanks for listening to WRKF, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.